You're listening to Big Questions, a part of the teaching ministry of First Baptist Church in downtown Tulsa. We exist to glorify God in all we do.
Well, I hope the class has been helpful for you. The Sunday one is going to continue on the rest of the list that we had when we started. And then after the holiday break for Christmas and New Year's, we're going to start a new class that I'll teach on sex and spirituality. So, you know, some of you may be like, I'm way past worrying about that stuff. But no, it's going to be, I think, a very helpful thing. I think churches for a really long time, when it comes to questions about sexuality, have mainly just had some very black and white statements about do's and do nots, and have not really put forward a holistic view of the story of sexuality in the Bible for human flourishing and for healthy life. And I think our culture is reaping the benefits of that. So I think the church needs to be more informed and understand all these issues so that we can be more compassionate as people struggle with sexual sin, all different types, and that we can be more of an advocate for the beauty of what God has made in marriage and sexuality. So we're going to be doing that for 14 weeks. And I know my mom said, I don't know if I can talk for 14 minutes about sexuality. She's in her 70s. So I said, yeah, well, we'll figure out something to talk about. But I think it'll be good. And well, I think it'll also be good just to talk about identity. So we're going to talk about that. You know, in our culture, when it comes to sexuality and gender, that's become identity kind of language, not just behavioral language. And we're going to talk about how that's changed and where we get our identity from. So I think that'll be useful as well. So we're going to finish with a really big question, and one that, you know, I've really come across three categories of Christians in this category in terms of the relationship between faith and science. The first category, I would say, I could care less what science says. I believe what the Bible says, right? This category of I don't pay any attention to what that says because I don't trust it or whatever. You know, that kind of mentality. And I empathize with that in the sense of there is a pecking order of truth, right? And God's truth in the scriptures is definitely higher. And then the second category of people, I would say, is ones that either see it as... either don't see the bigness of this problem, or they oversimplify it, right? So they make it to where, oh well, yeah, I know there's some small things, but you know, overall, faith and science agree, and it's not that big of a deal, and I think a lot of times the reason for that is they just think that we only disagree about really small things or things that are just not that massive, and then the majority of the young people that I've met that have gone up in the education system, at least since I was a kid, are usually in category three, which is at some point in my faith walk, this really shook me bad, right? This, how I reconcile the way academics see the world and the teaching of different sciences, and it's not just biology, it's all the sciences, talk about reality and then the way the Bible talks about reality. At some point, it really rattled me. And of course, I met people in college ministry all the time that were just like, they had a laundry list of those questions before we could even get to talking about Jesus. Of just like, do you believe, you know, Genesis is literal? And, you know, those kinds of things would come up really early. So it's a big deal. This is a question I'm probably more qualified to answer than any of the other questions I've tried to answer. So just as being a scientist and a person who studied theology, I've looked at this issue a long time. And I've been in communities with people who do astrophysics and biology and chemistry and all that. And I've been in communities of theologians. And so I think there are good answers here. But just to kind of get started to see where you are, how many of you see this as a kind of a big conflict in terms of the people you talk to or in even your own thought? Okay, not that many. How many of you feel like our culture regards Christians as biased against science or anti-science? Okay, most of you, right? So in category one, I think probably because your primary culture is Christian culture, you don't feel like this is a big conflict because it's just not for you. It doesn't hit you daily. But you do understand that the reputation of Jesus, as we asked in the second question, is on the line if we're thought of as stupid or unintellectual or backwards people because we disregard what science says. And I don't think that's the right approach. I don't think the approach is, well, we just kind of don't listen to what science has to say or defend against it. So is science and faith at odds? And I'm of course, not surprisingly argue no. But there is something that is at odds in our culture. And so we're going to work our way to that. And the way we're going to do that is, I think it's four movements. But we're going to start with the scientific revolution. So, you know, intuitively, you may think that, well, since human history began, we've probably been slowly progressing in scientific understanding. And that's the farthest from the truth. The scientific revolution was incredibly unique and has changed the world incredibly rapidly. So we want to talk about where did that come from, what's going on there, how does that relate to Christianity? And then we're going to talk about the rise of this worldview that I would call scientific naturalism, which is kind of a worldview that says if you're thinking about things that exist, the way to understand that is through scientific inquiry and no other, right? And we'll talk about that worldview. And then that'll lead us to what the real conflict is. And the real conflict is a world of theism or even deism. In other words, a world that sees there's a God behind reality and a world that does not, which is naturalism. And that's really not faith in science, right? That's faith in science is something separate, and these are worldviews that then decide how they're going to deal with faith in science. And then I'm going to talk about scientific naturalism because if this has shook you at some point in your faith or you know people that this shakes, it's because of this worldview. In other words, it's because they feel the pull that to be a smart person, I need to be a naturalist or I need to be a deist. And we'll talk about that, what that term means at the very most. I need to act as if nothing intervenes with what I see other than natural laws, right? And we'll discuss that. But that worldview is fatally flawed and is a really poor representation of any science that's actually happened between the 1500s and now. So that's where we're going, and we're going to quote a bunch of famous people on the way, and it'll be fun. So, all right, let me pray for us, and we'll get started. Father, we're thankful that you have revealed yourself through the scriptures and told us everything that we need for life and godliness, and we're also thankful that you are the author of creation and that everything that we see was made by you and for you and is sustained by Christ and your Spirit at work. And so as we talk today and we seek to uphold your scripture, but also to be those that apply ourselves to exercise dominion over this creation in ways that are wise and good and seek knowledge. We want to be those that don't shun knowledge where it can be found. I pray that you would give us wisdom as to how to do this in a world that's become very divided over these issues. It's in Jesus' name I pray. Amen. Okay, so what do we mean by science is where we have to start. And the definition I have there is science is a systematic study of the structure and behavior of the physical and natural world through observation and experiment. So if it's been a while since you've had any classes on science, right, you may or may not remember the scientific method. And so the scientific method really crystallizes what we mean by the word science in one way of thinking, and that is that we make observations, okay? Now those observations can be through our senses, which would be empirical data, or they can be through just our minds, like mathematics, which would be like logical data. And we make those observations, and then we come up with a hypothesis, okay? Hypothesis is a statement of, well, maybe this is the way things are working. And we come up with that statement, and then we test that. And so it depends on what kind of a statement it is, how you test it. And if it holds up to testing, then that hypothesis kind of moves forward towards becoming a theory. Otherwise, you'll revise your hypothesis and try again, right? If the testing shows that it's not true. So that's the scientific method. And what you see there is a couple of things. First, science is very based on tangible, empirical observation, okay? So it's not based on anything else. So if you want to study something like honesty or good parenting, yeah, and you can take a scientific approach, which is let me make a bunch of observations about what parents do, let me form a hypothesis of what works. You know, you can use the scientific method, but when you do qualitative science like that, you know, your results are going to be theories, kind of, but they're not going to be empirically tangible kind of theories, like you would test, like Newton tests gravity, for example, and says, oh, every time I let this go, it accelerates at the exact same rate. If I let something really light go, it reaches terminal velocity fast. And so, you know, those kinds of things. He's coming up with laws that always kind of define facts and figures and how things work. And then there's also a qualitative science like sociology, stuff like that, where you still use a scientific method and you're still using just your reason and your senses. But you're really trying to find predicting theories. Okay, so that's what science is always aiming at, is observing things well enough to come up with predicting theories. So science necessarily excludes anything that's not empirically or rationally observable or repeatable. In other words, science can't look at something that is a one-off situation or is not something that's available in my senses. So science can't, for example, measure, well, is there a spiritual world, or is love tangible? They can measure brain activity. You know, they can measure things, but there's a lot of intangible things that they don't really have a way of looking at through just pure reason or data. So when we say science, that's what we're talking about. Now, in the world, if you know much about human history, for the most part, we saw very little science in most of human history between, you know, whatever, however many thousand years BC up until 1500 AD. There were pockets of that, right? Like, we know the Greeks were really good at philosophy, in other words, metaphysics about, well, how does everything work? And then a guy like Socrates comes along and he's really good about psychology, asking people why you like the things you do and using questions to figure people out. But there's really almost nothing like what we think of as modern science at all. Now, there was mathematics, people working on mathematics, and of course, the Middle East is where mathematics pre the scientific revolution was the strongest. But for the most part, the way cultures worked before the scientific revolution is they would pursue what I would say is their imagination and technologies, maybe, but not science, not like what we do. And so for a modern person, it's difficult to really think back to that when, you know, like the Roman Empire, which was massive, or the Egyptians. Well, they put tons of work into language, into understanding the universe, but did they do it scientifically? No. Every time they saw something that was interesting, they defined it through some correspondence to the spiritual world. And that's been far more common to say, oh, there's the sun. Well, there's a God behind that. And there's lightning and there's a God behind that. Now, there's also dualistic worldviews. A lot of cultures are dualistic, which means they think that there's some sort of invisible world that's better or higher. And the physical world that we see now is actually baser or worse, or kind of traps us. So there's been lots of worldviews, but it wasn't until the 1500s in a Christian environment in Europe that we saw anything happen like the scientific revolution in human history. And there's a reason for that. So the Christian worldview, there's specific presuppositions that you need in order to do science. And they did not have that before Christianity was the predominant worldview. So let's talk about why that is. Let's see. So first off, modern science is an invented institution. So it's important that you realize that. It was invented, right? It wasn't this slow progress that, you know, at some point people were doing basic physics and... No. Newton invented physics. There was no physics before Newton, right? The biology, the way we think about it, that wasn't happening before. They were sticking leeches on people, and they were, you know, they were doing all kinds of crazy experiments or witch doctors or whatever, but there wasn't science like there is now, right? All of that stuff was invented in the 16th through the 18th centuries as pursuits. And modern science came particularly out of Christian metaphysics. Now, if you don't know that word, metaphysics, physics is just the study of how things are, right? And metaphysics means, well, what's your theory of everything? So when we talk about metaphysics, you're just like, what's the nature of all things? What's the nature of reality as a whole? So that's all that word means. And the things you need in order to decide it's worth my time to investigate the world in the way science does are these things. The physical universe is good, and knowledge of it is good. Okay, so the Christian worldview holds that view instead of dualistic worldviews that see the physical world as either limiting or evil. Christianity affirmed that God made everything good, and that goodness is further confirmed in the incarnation. A lot of the early scientists actually took their motivation from the incarnation, that God himself made himself part of the creation so the creation can be redeemed and used in good, right? A lot of those guys, Copernicus, Newton, Boyle, they thought this way. Next, the physical world is orderly and rational. So if you believe there are hundreds of gods that inhabit the lightning and all these other things, and they're at odds with each other, and what they're doing is reflected in, well, you don't expect order in things that are happening, right? If lightning hits your house, you think some god is mad at you. Or if you have a drought this season, you don't study the weather patterns. You say, well, we obviously didn't please this god. Or, you know, so it depends on your worldview. And we're so used to thinking of the world as orderly and rational in the modern era that we never think about the fact that that's new, right? That's pretty new. However, it is biblical. It's biblical that the world is not chaotic, that God's creation would be rational and orderly because God himself is one, so there's not competing gods behind creation, and he's purposeful and he's rational. So early scientists were expected that this was worthy of their time because of the way they understood God and metaphysical reality. And this order is both necessary. Mathematics is a good example of that. In other words, God can't contradict himself. You heard language like that. So if we figure out something, it's not going to change tomorrow. So it's necessary. And it's also conditional, which means I should expect that if something happens under certain conditions, I should be able to repeat that if I'm paying attention. Okay? And so for a long time, people believed, as a matter of fact, it may be for thousands of years, people believed that life spontaneously generated, right? You may have heard of spontaneous generation and laughed about it in your science class. But that actually existed up to the 1700s. But the difference was, in most of human history, spontaneous generation was viewed as, well, the gods kind of made something burst forth, right? Or produced something, or something spiritual leaped over. And then in the 1600s and 1700s, they were putting out meat and maggots would show up, and they're like, if I keep doing that, it happens over and over. So life does spontaneously start at this kind of embryonic state. Now Pasteur and some of these other guys were like, no, that's wrong. There were flies there. You guys, it's not a good experiment. But you see that their approach towards proving it was now expecting repeatable and necessary kind of realities. And that comes from a Christian worldview. Now, Christianity is not the only worldview they could have adopted that had some of these things, but this was the one that it was born out of. And then the next one, human sense perception and reason are reliable and correspond to reality. Okay? So why do I trust my senses? Why am I not being deceived all the time? Why do I think that my rational powers are good? Well, Thomas Aquinas and all of these guys had reclaimed the fact that reason is something that's given to us by God. It's part of being in his image. And we should be employing it to find truth and to exercise dominion over the created world and so on and so forth. And so that particularly also was consistent with the worldview. So if Europe had not been Christian, now that's not the only factor that produced the scientific revolution, but if Europe had not been Christian, if they had been almost any other competing worldview at the time, the scientific revolution likely would not have happened. You cannot think of an early scientist, it'd be very difficult, and you know, and even a philosopher, Descartes and Pascal and Newton, and that wasn't a theologian, that wasn't a Christian, and did this out of the impulse of figuring out the nature of God's ordered creation. Okay? Now, why is that important? Because right now, there's a mentality among scientists that if you hold those views, they're dissonant with science. And so there's a deep irony that those views, the views that there's a God and he's ordered creation and there's purpose in it, there's design in it, those kinds of things, were the only reason the scientific revolution happened. It's kind of ironic at this point that now those seem to be, you need to check those at the door in order to do science. And we'll talk about that. It's called methodological naturalism. And that's mainly how people do science now. So C.S. Lewis says it this way: men became scientific because they expected law in nature, and they expected law in nature because they believed in a law giver. Okay, so that's, you know, I said in 20 minutes what C.S. Lewis says in 20 words, which is pretty much normal. But yeah, the first three centuries of the modern era of science, which is the 16th century through the 18th century, faith and science were seen as allies in harmony with each other. Most scientists were Christians and pursued science as an expression of their faith. Copernicus, Galileo, Newton, Pascal, Boyle, you can hardly think of one that wasn't. Now, was there ever clashes between the institutional religion and science? Very, very few. And they get sensationalized today, right? Like Galileo, right? You guys remember that? Oh, Galileo was thrown in prison because he said the earth wasn't the center of the universe, right? It's not true. Now, was he actually put under house arrest? Yes, but it had nothing to do with his scientific discoveries. It had to do with the entire academy at that particular point in Europe based itself metaphysically, right, on Aristotelian ideas from Aristotle, right? So there were kind of competing views at the time. Aristotle, which is, I'm not going to bore you with these kind of frameworks of understanding, Aristotle, and then a new version of Platoism, it's called Neoplatoism, and then mechanism, which is kind of viewing creation, which is the one that won the day, by the way, is viewing creation as kind of a big clockwork that God set into motion, and now it runs, right? There's a mechanism reality. There's not these Aristotelian kinds or this Platoism kind of idea. And Galileo followed Copernicus, and he was not a very diplomatic guy. He was a brilliant guy, but he was a very brash person. And he saw such genius in Copernicus and was pushing against Aristotelian logic. And the church was like, well, that's how we based our... Because Aquinas had written all of the church's theology off of Aristotelian logic, right? That's how we do morals. That's how we do ethics. So it was really a philosophical debate between Galileo, and it was his personality that got him into trouble, right? There were other scientists that were very diplomatic in how they talked about these things that the church was very tolerant of, but he was kind of a bull in the china shop, and he was right, by the way. He was right about the conclusions of Copernicus and so on, and there was a Copernican revolution that happened, and he was part of that. But where he was wrong and kind of the way he approached it was just, even as a college student, he would just be there and be like, this is all wrong, you know, just completely brash. And so even today, if there was a student that was like that at a prestigious place like Oxford or Yale, I mean, they wouldn't be well received because of that attitude, right? And so those things get held up a lot of times, that we rewrite history as, oh, science and faith were at odds from the beginning. And that's just completely untrue. You know, Newtonian physics, Newton was a saint of the church. You know, he was revered by the church. All of these guys were, for the most part. And they worked equally on theology as they did on science. A lot of them wrote tomes on theology, guys like Pascal, right? And they were brilliant. They were a great help to the church and understanding of the natural world. So there was harmony there that started to break down with this mechanistic worldview. So what happened? Christian faith and science were understood as an alliance, and they pursued it that way. And then in the late 18th century, things started to change. And there was a lot of things contributing to this. One I mentioned, the Aristotle and Platonic ways of thinking was getting replaced by this mechanistic way of thinking. And by the way, guess what was happening in this period? What was happening in the 18th century? For us, it's relevant to us. Yeah, the United States was being formed. And the guys that formed it, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, they were shaped by the discussions that were being happening in Europe at this time. And so many of them, not all of them, but many of them were deists, which means that they believed that absolutely there has to be a God, because science would make no sense without a God. We wouldn't have a rational world. We wouldn't be able to understand it. But it seems as if, because we're switching over to this mechanistic view, that God has created everything and set it in motion and kind of stepped back. And now, if we track down the laws and the math and the science of how everything is working together, we'll be able to explain how his machine works. And so at the time, what did that do? It changed things, right? Well, what about resurrection? And what about, so there were new conversations about that. Well, the Bible says there's stuff that's not scientifically verifiable that happened. What do we feel about that? Well, that was a new conversation in the 18th century. People weren't talking about whether the resurrection was literal or not before then, in theology. And then in science, the progress was just extreme, because this mechanistic view in the little narrow field of scientific inquiry, especially in areas like astronomy and physics, I mean, it was just exploding, right? Newtonian physics, wow. I mean, we can figure out how everything moves and how energy is conserved and applied. And now, you guys probably hated physics when you were there, but if you knew all the things that we do that are based on what Newton did, right? So the whole world was exploding with knowledge, and it was changing things. And then the Enlightenment Project, which was started by Descartes, which is, let's get to truth that we don't have to doubt anymore. We don't have to doubt because it's indubitable. And he started with, I think, therefore I am, right? Well, that project failed. Because after a couple hundred years of wrestling with how do we get to undoubtable truth, we kind of figured out we can't, because we're finite and we're easily deceived. And so even our senses may not correspond to reality. The sci-fi movie The Matrix, right? If you like that movie. We're easily duped into thinking this is reality, and it might not be. And guys were talking about that in the 18th century. And Kant was trying to rescue philosophy and theology, because they're like, the Enlightenment's failed. We don't have undoubtable truth anymore. And then there was also the rise of liberalism and humanism, individual rights. Okay, so French Revolution, American Revolution, we know those expressions of it. But the writer behind that, the champion of liberalism and humanism, was Voltaire. And if you never heard of him, he's worth knowing about. And so he was exalting the freedom of the individual. We get things like freedom of speech, all that, really from that kind of base. And yet, he was casting off anything that would restrict individual rights and freedom. And that would include religion, right? So Voltaire was that way. And then starting with Francis Bacon, who started way earlier, there was a sect of people that just said, you know what, the only thing we can trust in is what we can see and touch. You know, so think of that. Seeing is believing statement, you know, we talked about before. All the way back from Francis Bacon, who was a master of empiricism in philosophy, there was a stream of people that were just like getting stronger and stronger in seeing is believing, kind of as a worldview, right? If I can't see it, it might as well not be real. And if I can't test it. And so that was happening too. And then, of course, we know new theories in biology with Charles Darwin. Now, what was so radical about Darwin wasn't evolution. Evolution was in biology being discussed for a long time before. It was natural selection. It was this idea that maybe the diversity of life we see on a planet has had no involvement other than natural processes. So what looks very designed and compatible and, wow, you know, trees help us and we help trees and all this beautiful synergy of nature, that's just an illusion. because there's natural processes that has created that complexity and that richness. Well, that was, if he's right, that was a big problem, right? That's a big change from even deism, which is God created all these kinds and set them in motion and so on. So that was shaking things up because Darwin was a really good scientist. And so he had proven for certain species that he'd studied in the Galapagos Islands and some other, and barnacles, random creature he studied. He had proven through those species that these species changed and nothing happened other than the environment changed, right? And they changed, they adapted. So what if all of them were that way? And he expected the fossil record would show us that once we figured it out, because archaeology wasn't a thing yet, right? We weren't digging up dinosaur bones. And so that started archaeology or paleontology. And of course, the fossil record didn't look anything like Darwin thought, but we've evolved the theory as we find new things. So all of that was happening at the same time in the 18th century. And what did that lead to? Okay. Well, the result by the middle of the 19th century, 1800s, right, is skepticism towards any metaphysical explanation, period. So what do I mean by that? If you tell me this is the way reality works, that's your opinion. I don't care if you're religious. I don't care if you're a philosopher. And so ironically, up until this point, religion and philosophy were considered the mother of all scientists. Why? Because what you believe there carried over into every other area, right? So whatever you believe is true about all reality will shape how you do biology, will shape how you do sociology, will shape anything else. So they were thought of as the mother. And now they were the kind of the redheaded stepchild, right? Why? Because we've lost confidence that you can say anything about metaphysics, about how all things work, that's not just purely conjecture. We've lost confidence in that. Okay, that changed. The next is all science started to be done through what I call methodological naturalism. So that's a big word, but it just means in the way we do science, we do not allow you to do science with religious convictions or philosophical convictions. You know, if you come in and you say, my philosophical conviction is that this race is sub to that race, well, you can't do science like that. Or that all races are equal, which in the 18th century would have been revolutionary, right? That's my conviction. It'd be like, well, you have to check that at the door. Just let science show you the way. Just let the lab tell you. Let your experiments and your observations tell you. So religious commitments have no place in science. Does that sound familiar? Because we're still doing that. Okay. There's movies like God's Not Dead, right? Well, it's not exactly that. But they're talking about how the Academy assaults religion. They don't really assault it. Rarely. You don't really see professors like in that movie very often that just have a chip on their shoulder. Because as that movie shows, if you do, it's because religion is important to you. It's not because it's not important to you. But most of them are just like, you can believe whatever you want. It just has no place here, right? That's the way it normally is done. Well, that's methodological naturalism. And then God started to change in the vision of the Academy. And we started to see God as what we call the God of the gaps. But we see all of nature as, well, this is an expression of God, and we understand how the cardiovascular system works. We understand how men and women have children, reproduce. We understand all these things in biology, but there's some gaps. We don't know, you know, how plants and animals are connected. We don't, okay, well, that's where God can still be the explanation. Now, And Christians have gotten used to this definition to where we don't even really war against it, because this is an incredibly non-biblical way to think of God. In other words, what we understand has never been something that defines God. If God were to say in a dream to me, Chris, you're going to work at First Baptist last year. You know, Chris, you're going to work at First Baptist Tulsa next year, and I'd be like, wow, that's amazing. And then when I woke up, there was an angel at the door who led me to the church and told Darren to hire me, right? Or I got that same dream, and then, you know, my mom sent the resume, which is what really happened. And that whole process happened very naturally. Well, that's God, right? We don't think that way. We think of God as he's working in all things. He's the one that animates my body. He sustains my life, though I know I have to breathe and eat and... You know what I mean? So this God of the gaps really reduced God. And what it changed God into is every time we have a scientific discovery, God gets smaller and less necessary. You're like, what? That's not the God of the Bible, right? It's a very weird way to see God. But it happened because there were some philosophers at this time that said religion is a limiting factor, methodological naturalism. And so the more we can figure out, the less we have need of God as an explanation. And as a scientist, that's a victory. But as a Christian, that's nonsense. Right? It's like, you don't need God any less because you know. Let me try to give you some examples of this, because this is really stupid, except we believe it all the time, right? We just take this.
We even say it.
Yeah. And so let me give you an example. If I were to go home and I'll give you two examples. I had to put a kettle on to boil the water, right, because I want to have a cup of tea. And the water starts to boil. And I were to ask you, why is the water boiling? Well, you could say to me, well, there's heat that's heating up the metal of the thing, and water is a liquid that has a boiling point of 100 degrees or 212 degrees. And when it gets to that point, the molecules of the water are vibrating so much against each other, they're starting to create friction, and that friction actually breaks down the molecules, and it releases oxygen, and that oxygen comes up in steam. And you could go through that. And then I could look at you and say, no, the water's boiling because I put the kettle on, right? That's why. Now, who's right? Well, we're both right. But the stupidity of this is saying, okay, I just explained to you how water boils, so there definitely then can't be a person who put that kettle on. So what are you talking about? That's completely unrelated to you understanding that. Let me give you another example. A car drives by. It's the 1920s, right? You're like, what in the world is that? How does that work? And somebody comes up to you, and then they explain the laws of internal combustion. That, oh, there's fuel in there, and then there's pulls in oxygen, that creates fire, and it pops, and then the cylinder goes up, and that creates rotation, and it propels that car along. And you get it. You get the theory. So you're just like, oh, okay, great. And then you meet Henry Ford, and he says, I made that car. It's like, no, you didn't. That car is the product of internal combustion. I don't need to believe in a creator. That's not the same question. That's just stupid, right? Does that make sense? Okay. That's what reducing God to this is. That's taking away personal agency because I've figured out how something works. That's stupid. Okay? So don't be intimidated by that. And also understand that many people, the reason they're having trouble believing in God is this kind of definition of Him. Well, I know we don't really know where life came from. Maybe that's why there's a God. No, everything is why there's a God. I could give you billions of things that we fully understand that are more evidence for God. We'll talk about that. Okay. So these kind of contributing ideas led to a worldview change. Okay, so it wasn't science that's the problem. It is a shift in worldview called scientific naturalism. Now, what is scientific naturalism? It's a view that the natural world is fully explained by natural laws and forces and should be understood only from scientific investigation. Okay, so skepticism and the dominance of methodological naturalism in the academy. In other words, a lot of people if you're a professor, it doesn't mean that you are a scientific naturalist as a worldview, but I bet it does mean you feel the pressure that in the science classroom, I practice naturalism. I act as if that's all that's true, right? That's methodological naturalism. Anyway, so the radical skepticism towards any metaphysical idea and then the dominance of methodological naturalism in the academy led to the rise of scientism. Okay, scientism is an epistemology, which is to say, how do I know something? And scientism says the only way you could know it is if you see it, taste it, touch it, or it's a product of pure reason. Otherwise, it's just your opinion. Okay, that's scientism. That gave the rise to that. And scientism says that scientific inquiry is the only source of reliable knowledge. Okay, so the real conflict then is not between faith and science. It's between theistic view of the world, there's a God, and naturalism. Now look at how diametrically opposed these are. Theism says the universe is not all that exists. Naturalism says the universe is all that exists, right? Theism says God is ultimate reality. Naturalism says mass and energy is ultimate reality. Theism says the universe gives evidence for God. Naturalism says the universe gives no evidence for God. You see, that's why whenever I figure something out of the universe, then I never see God in it. Theism says reality is understood through science and theology, right? You have to understand the physical world to understand reality, but you also understand where it came from, what it's for, what's behind it, those kinds of things. And naturalism says, no, it's just science. That's all there is. That's the only way you understand reality. So these are diametrically opposed to each other. Let me give you an example. So some of you know the name Stephen Hawking. Stephen Hawking is a brilliant astrophysicist who's focused mainly on origins theory. He wrote a book on the Big Bang Theory, right? Years and years ago, has been a big proponent of the Big Bang Theory. He's since moved away from that and thinks string theory is a better explanation of all things. But he wrote a book in 2010 called The Grand Design. It's a tongue-in-cheek thing because it's the first book he wrote as a complete, clear atheist. And it's because he became convinced after studying gravity, and string theory is a big part of this, studying gravity and how that incorporates with what Einstein said, that something could come from nothing. He was convinced that that provided the raw materials where maybe something could come out of nothing. And this is a statement from his book. It's just amazing to me. A brilliant man can say this. Because there is a law of gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. Now, if you're a philosopher, you'd be like, you get a D on this statement. You know, this is a horrible statement of logic, right? First off, why is there a law of gravity? Because there is one. It's like, well, that's a big question you just left hanging there. And then secondly, can and will is incredibly like intentional driven into the law. Like the law has intent, not just ability, right? Not just I can mathematically explain it, but it has intent. Just like the law of gravity has no intent, right? It's not even a real thing. It's just something that describes how things work. It's not a thing in itself. So this is one of my favorite statements from Ludwig Wittgenstein. He's a philosophy of science guy. But he says, the great delusion of modernity is that the laws of nature explain the universe. It's like the laws of nature describe the universe and its regularities. They explain nothing. The law of gravity tells me what things do. It doesn't tell me why. It doesn't tell me where it came from. It doesn't tell me why it's repeatable. One of my favorite quotes about this is, it's a little later, I think, than this, is from Einstein. He says, the only incomprehensible thing about the universe, and what he means by incomprehensible in this sense is, we could never figure this out. Not, we don't know it now. The only incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it is comprehensible. Now, what does he mean? That we can actually rationally perceive it. We can never figure that out. And why does it follow these laws? We don't know. It's incredible. So another great example of that is Roger Sperry. So imagine you found a piece of paper in the back of the, and it had, you know, it had things written on it in ink that may be language, but you couldn't tell what it was. And so whether you know the language or whether you don't, the statement he makes in his book about this is the meaning of a message will not be found in the chemistry of the paper and the ink. So imagine a person who found that and said, okay, I understand how paper works. I figured out how ink works. So now I fully explain this reality. So, no, there's a message in it. So think of DNA, right? So I understand now that the reason we have defects and deformities, the reason we have dark hair and light hair, is because there are 3.5 billion pieces of information strung together in the simplest life form that program that. Okay, so we don't need God anymore. What? He's like, where did that come from? There's 3.5 billion pieces of information in every single one of your cells that define exactly how you will be made. And they're like, okay, we figured it out. It's just like, what? So that's why Francis Collins, the guy who mapped the human genome, is like, of course I'm a theologian, you know, of course I'm a theist. It's like, look at this. It's like 1 million pages of information to map the human genome or whatever it is. So, okay, so you see where I'm going. Okay, so naturalism misrepresents. Okay, so why is naturalism so bad? I kind of skipped over a couple of these. First, science describes, it doesn't truly explain, create, or answer questions of value or meaning or purpose or why. It just doesn't do that. So if you're a scientific naturalist, all those questions are just like, that's not a question we can even think about. Why is there a universe? Oh, that's a nonsense question. There is no why. It's like, well, of course there's a why. Why is it so fine-tuned for life? Why are there billions and billions and billions of stars, and yet we seem to be the only planet that has this kind of thing going on? It doesn't matter. You know, there's no why. It just is. Well, that's a horrible worldview, right? It might be good for studying astronomy, but it's a horrible worldview. Naturalism misrepresents God as God of the gaps. Knowing the laws and mechanisms of something doesn't preclude agency, right? That is a separate question. Now, is it true that if God is behind creation and he's invisible, can I not empirically investigate him? Yeah, that's true. I have to investigate him instead with my mind, with my conscience, with my reason, seeing, well, we're specifically unique. What do I learn about studying humanity? Why do we have moral inclinations like we do? Why do we, you know, so there's lots of ways I can reason my way to God and use my mind, but I can't do it in a lab, right? So that's true. But just because I've figured out laws and mechanisms doesn't mean I explain agency away. That's just crazy. And so we talked about the car and internal combustion engine. Okay, naturalism also ignores reasonable metaphysics. So I told you this, there's a skepticism towards metaphysics. They're coming up with all of these laws, all of these brilliant, brilliant laws of how things work. Why are these laws? Why are these laws? I remember a study that somebody did simulating the Big Bang, kind of, you know, what they think might have happened. And one of the interesting conclusions he had, you know, if you don't know, Big Bang really heavily depends on gravity as how things actually formed, how all of it formed the way it is. And he figured out that if gravity as we experience it was like 0.1% lower or higher, there would either never have expanded a universe, or it would have expanded infinitely and nothing would have clustered together and created galaxies. And these kind of fine-tuning things are coming up all the time, where every time we try to model anything that's happening, if we change the way things actually are by just a tiny bit, it doesn't work. Life is a great example of that, right? So it was many, many years ago that the first time they were ever in a lab able to dump a ton of kind of biological material into a spot and see one amino acid come out, right? And that was a huge revolutionary thing at the time to say, oh, well, the amino acid is part of a building block for life, and so this is a step towards proving life could come out of just protoplasmic ooze. The problem is that that's one of like hundreds of thousands of different things that have to happen all at the same time, all in a tiny same place for one cell. You know, it's just, you're not anywhere closer. It's like, I want to go to the moon and, all right, I'm almost there. You know, it's just, you're not any closer to that gap. And so, but that's the kind of thing we do in science. And instead of being in wonder of how incredibly fragile life is, how incredibly complex it is, sophisticated, balanced, all these things, we just immediately skip over that. And there's some clear, reasonable metaphysical discussions that should happen there, right? Why is our universe seem so purposeful? Why do we not follow our own moral inclinations as people that share? We shall not murder, and then murder's happening everywhere. Why are we wired that way? You know, those are important discussions, and a sociologist would be like, oh, that's a that's not worth asking. I just need to study trends and data. Okay, well, that's stupid, right? That's ignoring too much. And so, yeah, we talked about Einstein. Next is naturalism. Oh, sorry. Naturalism ignores the fine-tuning. The next one is naturalism does not respect intuitive, moral, or spiritual aspects of human knowledge. My example on this is, let me see if I can find it here. If you were to go to a scientist and say to him, you know, do you think there should be ethics for scientists? Should they have to be honest in their reporting? And of course. Why? If you're a scientific naturalist, you cannot ground any reason for that. Well, I just know that. How? I have a conscience. I have intuition. I understand the purpose for which we do science. Well, none of that's science. Those are all other ways of knowing. And you're right. You're coming to a conclusion that I bet would be universally accepted as it's very important scientists are honest in their findings. Otherwise, they're counterproductive. But why do I hold that value? Not because of scientific investigation. And there's a million things I could give you like that are just like, well, that's it doesn't work. You can't devalue these other ways of knowing for just pure lab work, you know. Okay, naturalism depends. This is the, in my opinion, this is the defeater of scientific naturalism as a worldview. In other words, you can't logically hold it as a worldview. Naturalism depends on it, our capacity for reason, which itself, the naturalist believes, is the product of chance, unguided processes. So let me flesh this out for you. The one thing that the naturalist is basing all of reality on, their view of everything, is that what's reliable is my senses and my brain. But where does the naturalist think that my senses and my brain came from? No purpose, chance, unguided processes that produced this because it was the most tenable in this environment for survivability. Well, why would I trust that? Wouldn't it deceive me if it could keep me alive? Of course it would. If that's the force that produced it. And Darwin was plagued by this. He says, with me, the horrid doubt always arises whether the convictions of man's minds, which have been developed from the lower animals, are of any value or are all trustworthy. Now, you see the irony here? By removing God, they've put themselves as the grounder of reality, but also by removing God, they've given themselves no dignity and reason to trust their own capacity to know things. So, the way I would say that is, atheism removes the grounding metaphysical assumptions that came in the scientific revolution from Christianity to validate the very rationality we need, not only for science, but for any thinking or judgment to be valid. Why must scientists trust their own minds? Why should the scientists be honest in their own findings? They can't ground these things. So what inevitably happens is they claim scientific naturalism as a worldview, and they try to practice their discipline that way, but then they're constantly invalidating that by value statements and by accusing people of things. They're just like, no valid. What's your basis for that? Like, you don't have any reason for that. So, okay. Make sense? So, all that's to just conclude, Christians should be the best scientists. Now, why? Because we believe that God is behind this. He created order. That as we understand the order with which he was created, we can do things in his image good with that, right? If a Christian person was behind searching for the cure for cancer, well, I think the commands of Jesus should motivate him more than just the average scientist's desire to solve the problem, right? I think it's a better motivation. If a Christian scientist was working on splitting the atom, well, I think the restrictions on what God says we can do for our own self-interest is a better guide to him than just somebody who's advancing technology, right? Or trying to solve a problem, or a utilitarian. If a Christian values of all life has dignity is doing biology, I think he would avoid the pitfalls that we've had with evolutionary thought, like, well, there are some races that are less evolved, and so they should be wiped out. which the founder of Planned Parenthood believed, which Hitler believed, right? Well, that came from evolutionary thinking. Well, what if a Christian was doing that biology? Well, they could never conclude that out of their worldview, that all life is in the image of God and has dignity, unless they denied what the scriptures said. So Christians should be great at it because we have a better metaphysics to ground reality, right? So don't be afraid of science, and don't be intimidated by those that have built a worldview out of it that excludes or tells you to check your religion at the door. All right, questions? Yeah.
Do you think there's room in the academy for atheists?
Yeah, and I think there's great examples of it. So I think you could look at Robert George in political theory at Princeton. I think you could look at Alvin Plantinga at Notre Dame, who's one of the most well-respected philosophers alive. The two Nobel Prize winners for physics were both committed evangelical Christians last year. It happens all the time. The problem is that it's not the narrative that's being written about science, and it's not the culture of the academy. And that for that to change, what has to happen is methodological naturalism has to be seen as, you're not protecting anyone. And there's been some hope in that area, in the sense of, one of the main motivators for saying, well, let's be methodologically naturalist, is to prevent bias, right? So to prevent the creation scientist coming in and saying, I'm going to look at the evidence biased towards validating that I think the Earth is young. And that's why that gets parodied so badly by scientists. It's like, well, that's what we're worried about religion will do. And so that's a good motivation. The problem is you just trade it for another set of biases, right? So scientists don't do any thinking in a vacuum. So if you're a biologist, nobody's testing evolution anymore, right? They're not going back and saying, well, did this species evolve? Was this one of those that evolved? They just assume that, and then they try to explain what they're seeing through the lens of that theory. And I don't fault them for that. If there were a Copernican revolution in biology that said, oh, we got a better theory for how all of life relates to each other, they would change those presuppositions, right? If that was convincing. So what I'm saying is religious presuppositions aren't any different than, you know, the academy saying spontaneous generation is the best means of explaining life that we have right now, or evolution is the best means of life we have right now. Same with astrophysics. Astrophysics is where one of the areas I studied. And what's funny about it is there's been Copernican revolutions like every 30 years. So you don't have this kind of, oh, well, this is fact kind of mentality anymore, because you have poly versus Big Bang, dark matter, string theory. There's stuff coming out all the time because the math and physics are so complicated. And so people will come out with a new system that might make sense of it all. And so all I would say is that what needs to happen is you don't have to check your convictions about metaphysics at the door, your philosophy. And another thing that I wish would change is we should teach philosophy and religion, metaphysical thinking, to high schoolers. We shouldn't wait until it's an elective in college. And so I'm not a proponent of let's squeeze ID into science, into biology class. Why? Because ID is metaphysics. Intelligent design is what ID means, right? Saying that, oh, well, when we look at biology and we take a step back, we think metaphysically, it's very hard to explain what we see here without there being some sort of intelligence behind it. That's a philosophy class when you did that. It's not a biology class anymore, which is fine. But I think that just shows the need that we should be doing philosophy and religious studies and ethics and things like that for high schoolers. And it shouldn't just be optional if you want to go into that in college. Because people are orphaned in that kind of a thinking today. Yeah.
Have you heard this is a good example to prove what you were talking about. Have you heard about the guy that was working on Hoover Dam and how he got they were trying to figure out something that would take all this electricity and transport it where it needed to go, but they couldn't find something to work with, you know, these little, well, they used to, and he got, I guess, I don't know how he got on the black market or whatever, a piece of the pots that they used back those in Jesus' day.
Yeah, yeah. Ceramic. Yeah, no, let me cut you off just for time. But ceramic inductors is how they use.
And
so I think that's a good example of how science would preclude there's any way to know anything other than empirical investigation, instead of spiritual ways, intuitive ways, conscientious ways. And so this guy came to a scientific conclusion, but through a spiritual path that a scientist would say, well, that's not valid. And probably would explain away, would say, well, you had a mystical experience that was imaginary, but the truth is that you probably remembered the properties of ceramics from somewhere else, right? So I absolutely agree with you that that's one of the problems. And so I think we'd be much better served if in classes on biology, they could talk about ethics or intuition or things like that. And they practice it that way. Like in the lab, a biologist would use their intuition, they would use their gut, they would use all kinds of things. But then they can't write that way, right?
You know the difference between Hebrew thinking and Greek thinking?
They think in multi directions.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Chris, in this academy, what makes one in the academy?
Well, it's just like any other field. So here's a good example. If I were to say, I want to go in the medical field, well, I'll spend all this time in medical school, and then I'll go to residency. And what will happen is I'll pick up the cultural expectations of that field by being around doctors. So for example, do I pray with my patients? Well, I'll probably figure out by being around doctors whether that's frowned upon or not. Do I have emotional connections with them? Things like that. So
biology academy, physics academy?
No, I would say when you go into academics, when you decide to get a master's degree and a PhD and work in the academy, what you figure out is that either one of two things. If you have religious convictions, those aren't respected here. It depends on what institution. Or you can have those, great, but check them at the door when you do your work because they're of no value here. And in some fields, that's not that huge of a deal, like math, right? But in other fields, like anthropology or sociology, then you're like, well, that's the ethics I understand that ground all reality. So in those fields, I think they're really suffering. Psychology is another good example. Like, they're trying to figure out what causes depression without talking about sin ever. And so you're just like, well, I think you have a deficient view of humanity because you're only trying to understand it by what's happening in the brain, and that's just not going to fully explain depression, right?
So the majority controls the conclusions?
Well, there's always dissonance, and there's Christians in all these fields. But usually when they publish, if any of that creeps into their writing, it gets discredited. And like I said, it's not because of what they think of Christianity necessarily. It's because of this commitment to methodological naturalism. So what I'm saying is, if we have to prepare our kids for that, to say, hey, this is the way it's done, don't let it be a threat to you. But they're wrong in saying that the things you understand about reality from faith, from your family's relationships, from friendships, those are all valid ways of knowing. And so don't think you have to check that stuff at the door. That's all part of who God's made you to be. And I think we can weather it okay. And then I think Christians are too divorced from the academy. I think the more we put Christians in these fields to say, Alvin Plantinga is a great example. I mean, he's not just a Christian philosopher. He's a Christian philosopher that said, you can't tell me I can't believe in God. I'll actually prove to you philosophically it's a better way to think. And he did. And so everybody started to respect his epistemology because he was just good at it.
Yeah.
So I think Christians have to kind of get back into those roles instead of kind of being scared of it and keeping a distance.
Do you have any sense that will actually happen?
I mean, that's one of the things our ministry was trying to do, is going to the places like Yale and Harvard that are producing most of the professors at prestigious universities and saying, hey, you know, your worldview is actually a better ground of reality. And you can practice all these things from that. So yeah, so we hope that would produce it, and other ministries are doing that as well.
Well, I've heard that, at least in the field of philosophy, that actually Christianity has made some gains in particular.
Major gains.
In that same book that you quote, Hawking declared philosophy dead.
Right.
Put this much back.
Right. And of course, Nietzsche declared God dead, you know, 100 years earlier. So so philosophy really had, before Plantinga, Volderstorff, who, by the way, Darren has been quoting for the Quartet of the Vulnerable. Volderstorff is a peer philosopher, great Christian man. Some of these guys are actually in the top four or five philosophers in the world, and they're devoted Christians, and so it's changed it just by those couple of people. And so, yeah, I think there's hope everywhere. At NASA, now NASA is a little bit of a weird science place because we're looking at the stars, and I do think there's something to, you know, Psalm 19. If that's your field of study, you're going to have a hard time denying God. But still, I knew tons of people who were committed Christians and were some of the best people at NASA, right? Astronauts, others. And because part of why they did things that they did and part of what the joy that motivated their work ethic was the connectedness to the worldview that explained these realities. So I think that can happen lots of places. But we have to kind of buck the status quo, right? So it's the doctor that says, I'm here for people. I'm not here to follow the medical codes or to adapt to the culture of a hospital. I'm here to care for people because God's called me to people. It's that kind of doctor. It's that kind of lawyer that says, I'm a divorce lawyer, but it's not about the money that we make. It's about trying to help these families heal if they are divorcing or maybe even get back together, even if it costs us money, right? So it's people that will do that in banking and every field. But the academy is one where there's just not a lot of Christian engagement. You know, there's not a lot of Christian professors at prestigious schools relative to other fields.
So, Chris, if Genesis 1 is probably the most common division between science and faith.
Yeah.
And dating, our means
right.
of scientific dating.
Yes.
Is the basis for each of those arguments. Is that solvable or?
Oh yeah.
Are we just going to have to choose our own course?
No, I think it's solvable. I think the interesting thing again, I'm going to do origin science in the next part of this series on Sundays, but the interesting thing is the young earth literalist view of creationism was born in the same time period, this 18th century, really became popular as a rebuttal to what was coming out. And it wasn't the way people had usually read the Bible. And there's good reasons for that. Like, we're products of the modern era. We're products of picking up a book and reading it like it's a history book or like it's a linear story. All these things that we've been programmed to read like. And we do the same thing with the Bible. We read it as if, well, what does it say about reality? What's the order of these events? And we know the Bible's not always in order. I mean, the Gospels jump around in order all over the place. They don't include everybody in the genealogies. They don't do anything the way we want them to. And Genesis 1, there's all kinds of indicators that we don't know if these were days or not, and like 24-hour days. You know, the sun and moon don't exist in the first 3 days. The order completely changes in chapter 2 of what was created. Day 7 is a day of rest. Well, is that 24 hours he rested and started creating again? No, he's still resting, right? So these days, I think what happened is, as science was saying, this is how we think things happen in history, it turned people to eyes in the Bible to say, well, what would the Bible say in rebuttal to that? And that's where really our young earth creationism started as a view of how to interpret that. So I don't think that's the best way to understand Genesis 1. I understand why people do, and I'm sympathetic to the fact that they're trying to defend the Bible. But, I mean, the first line is, in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth was void and without form, and the Spirit of God hovered above the waters. And the creation week hasn't started. And there's the earth, there's water, there's heaven and the earth. When? It doesn't say, in the beginning. He creates Adam and Eve. Were Adam and Eve adults when he created them? We don't know, right? Because in chapter 2, it sounds like they were. Chapter 1, there's no indication they were already adults. So I'm just saying that the story is telling you, I don't care. That's not what I'm telling you. I'm not trying to ground metaphysics of science here. I'm trying to ground metaphysics of meaning. I'm trying to say, I'm the origin of things. I started it out. I have a purpose. This is the purpose for human beings. I've created a world of order and boundaries and so on. And if I had time, I would walk you through the 6 days and show you that the 6 days do actually function in the narrative to tell us the order with which God was creating, but not the timeline. And at least that's the way I interpret it. And that's an ancient interpretation. That goes back all the way to the 4th century.
You
so,
believe morning and evening actually meant?
It's a refrain. So that's a poetic refrain. If you look at...
That's what you're saying.
He's finishing every day with a... And it was morning and it was evening. It was the first day. But again, there's so many indicators that these weren't 24-hour periods because there wasn't sun and moon until the 4th day. And the last day isn't a 24-hour period.
Well, if it's just 24 hours, I mean... 24 hours, things can, I mean, things aren't going to die in 24 hours.
Right, right. So right, well, we don't know. I'm just saying we don't know. And so we got into those arguments when science started to say something new, and we started to say, well, what should be the counter argument from the Bible? And I think if we went with fresh eyes to say, Genesis 1 is grounding the book of Genesis, it's not grounding our science textbooks, what purpose does it serve in the book of Genesis? It's a book, right? It has a purpose in that context. Then I think we see it's defining who God is, it's defining who we are in relationship to him, it's defining the boundaries he set that's going to later be reflected in the law he gives to Israel in Exodus. So it has a great purpose, but it's not the purpose of answering all of our trivia questions about how old the earth is. So I think science is going to constantly be trying to change its perspectives as it gets more data. Christians don't have to fear that, but I don't think we should try to use the Bible to do biology. Because it's not intended for that.
But we have, and we've allowed the world to trap us in that.
Yes,
argument.
And that's why we don't want to do it. That happened with Copernicus, you know. Psalm 19 says the sun, like a strong man, runs its course with joy. So you're wrong, Copernicus, the sun is moving, the earth isn't. Well, that was bad reading of Psalm 19. It's a poem. That's poetic language. That's phenomenological language. That's how I experience the sun. That's not talking about how they actually move in space. But they were trying to defend the Bible. So we just have to be careful of that. And I do think there is a better interpretation of Genesis just on its own, Genesis 1 and 2. And I'll be covering that in the next few weeks.
Do we have to miss our life group to come here?
Yeah. Come to the Sunday one? Yeah. But my notes will be available. Yeah. So the notes from those classes will be available and things like that. Let me pray for us and we'll be done. Father, we thank you that we are fearfully and wonderfully made. We thank you that what you've told us is true, that you are God and we are not, that we are made in your image, that you've created an ordered creation that's good and that is for our good, and that you are reigning over it. All of these things are helpful for us as we study your world, as we observe it. And so help us not be threatened by science. Help it not to create doubt in our hearts, but instead help us to be grateful that science is constantly revealing your power, your beauty, your glory, as we get pictures from deep space, as we see the complexities of our own DNA and understand just how fearfully and wonderfully made we are. Help us to rejoice instead of to be afraid of what it says about our belief in God. And so, and help us to raise up in this church and others good scientists, good people to engage in all aspects of our culture so that it can be redeemed by the presence of your Son. It's in Christ's name I pray. Amen.